I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 26th of March. We are getting very close to the deadline for sign up for the Affordable Care Act, March 31st. People who don't sign up for insurance by that deadline will face financial penalties of up to 1% of their yearly household income, $95 a person, whichever amount is higher. There are exceptions, of course, for people if they experience a major life change. And there was also news today that if you're in the process of signing up for insurance, you will get an extension to sometime in April to make sure that you can get all the work done that needs to be done. There are some states that are experiencing some significant problems still: Maryland, Massachusetts, Nevada, Oregon, and Vermont. Problems with contracts with software companies and other kinds of problems, and some of those are Democratic states. We will talk about that. The big questions, of course: how many people have signed up? How many young people have signed up since open enrollment began in October? How many people have signed up in the last 2 weeks? And what happens to the whole healthcare conversation once we pass this March 31st deadline? Does it change our conversation about the Affordable Care Act? Are there indications that this is going to work or there will be some problems? We are interested in hearing your stories during the course of this hour. I'm sure many of you listening have signed up for this, and you can tell us about your experiences, what your joys are concerning this, and what your concerns are as well. Our guest is Professor Dylan Robbie. He's an assistant professor of health services in the UCLA School of Public Health and a research scientist with the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. His areas of expertise are the U.S. healthcare system and healthcare affordability. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. We love having a conversation going on Facebook, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Robbie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Let's start with the number of people, if we know such figures. We keep hearing that everybody waited till the last minute, and we've seen a number of people sign up just in the last couple weeks. Do we know that? Is that true?
So we've seen about 5 million reported enrolled in overall in all federal health insurance exchanges through mid-March, and that includes the state-based exchanges with about 1.5 million in those and about 2.5 million or so in the federal one. And then, based on that trend, I would anticipate another million people will probably end up signing up in the last 2 weeks because the last time they reported data at the end of February, they were only at about 4.2 million.
Mm-hmm. And the president had wanted 7 million, is that right?
Well, I don't know that the president wanted 7 million. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that by 2014, 7 million would sign up, and then they revised that estimate down to 6 million once they saw what happened with the rollout of healthcare.gov with the difficulties in the health insurance exchange setup with the various data sources talking to each other and people having problems signing up. And that has repercussions on the federal budget because the subsidies are based on tax credits, and if the CBO knows that fewer people will sign up, they will receive some federal savings because of lack of giving out those tax credits.
Mm-hmm. Today we heard that the administration is going to grant some extra time to Americans who are having a hard time getting it all together before next Monday. People wait till the last minute, and so they haven't filled out all the forms or all their questions have not been answered. Is that an indication that there probably are a whole lot of people who have waited until the last minute to do this?
Well, I'm not sure if we know that a lot of people have waited until the last minute. That's certainly human nature. And I think there's a poll from Kaiser Family Foundation saying that a majority of Americans don't even know that the deadline is March 31st, which I think is surprising, but because there has been so much attention. But in essence, what the Department of Health and Human Services has said is for people in states that are in an exchange run by healthcare.gov, that if you have logged in and tried to sign up for a plan by March 31st, by the deadline, if you don't get in and there's some barrier, you're able to sign up in the next couple of weeks, and all you have to do is self-attest that you tried to sign up and weren't able to because of some technical barrier or glitch.
Isn't that a sad commentary on Americans that people don't even know? How can you not know after all the conversation about the Affordable Care Act and the deadlines and the push in the last few weeks, particularly? How could you not know the deadline is March 31st? Where are you living?
Well, I think some people are, you know, kind of they're removed from it because they're not going to be signing up in the individual market. They already have employer-based insurance. So
right.
Surveying everyone who's in the entire country about it may be different than targeting those who would benefit from the program. So I would be more worried about people who have been uninsured not knowing that the deadline is coming up. But we have, you know, language issues in different states. We have confusion about what the Supreme Court ruled and whether states are expanding Medicaid or not. And I don't know if you've seen the famous Jimmy Kimmel sketch at this point, but when he goes out on Hollywood Boulevard, which is very close to where I live, and asks people if they like Obamacare and if they like the ACA, which are synonymous, they say very different things. So I'm not sure that people have been paying attention as much as we think they have.
Yeah, and yet it was 4 years ago this bill was signed. It's also hard to believe it's been 4 years and how much controversy there's been over a long period of time.
Absolutely. I think the fact that, you know, we were waiting until June of 2012 for the Supreme Court to issue a decision, and the decision they made about making the Medicaid expansion optional is, you know, an important policy decision. But the fact that they upheld the individual mandate and this requirement that people have to buy insurance or pay a tax penalty is probably the most important thing that people need to be aware of and make sure that they have creditable coverage so they don't get penalized on their taxes next year.
Mm-hmm. I think this was in the Washington Post, Dylan, but this article surprised me. Some of these states are Democratic states. Implementation, the author wrote, has been a relative disaster in Maryland, Massachusetts, Nevada, Oregon, and Vermont. Evidently, they've had problems with contract, with software companies, the contracts, and with people running the system. They've had a long time to get this together. What's happened in those states, and how does that affect the Affordable Care Act as it carries forward?
Well, I think it's a combination of issues. You mentioned that these four or five, Maryland, Nevada, Oregon, Vermont, are all democratically led states. And so they tended to be out in front in terms of making sure they were going to run their own state-based exchange rather than deciding not to and allow the federal government to run it for them. Whereas in more Republican-led states, they just deferred to the federal government from day one rather than even talking about running their own state exchange. So if you think about a small state like Vermont or Oregon trying to create this massive IT infrastructure, feed into all these different data sources you need from the IRS, from health plans themselves, it's a hard job to do. And they all had procurement processes to select vendors to do it, and some of them ran into problems, and some of them didn't. So here in California, I believe Accenture ended up being the IT vendor that created the Covered California website, and although there were some hiccups early on, it seems like they did a pretty good job making all those systems talk to each other, and you haven't seen Covered California having to deal with the same issues around contracting that other states have.
What are people going to like about this act, and what are people finding problematic and will continue to find problematic?
I think what people will like about the act is that they do have, in the individual market now, they will have guaranteed issue insurance coverage, which basically means that if you want to buy coverage during an open enrollment period, regardless of your age, regardless of your health status, regardless of what diseases you may have, an insurance company cannot turn you down and they cannot charge you more because you are sicker or older or have more health needs. So I think that consumer protection is going to be really helpful for people who have long been held out of the insurance market because of pre-existing conditions. The other thing that I think people aren't really paying attention to is the fact that even though some of these plans appear to have high deductibles, up to $5,000 for an individual, there's actually a provision of the law that requires an out-of-pocket maximum so that people who are single are protected to only spend $6,350 on deductibles and cost sharing in the year. So really the ACA, even though it may provide some better access to high deductible coverage in some cases for people who don't want to pay a lot for their premium, it still is acting as a bankruptcy protector where you cannot exceed $6,350 as an individual for spending by law. And so there's a lot more of that back-end protection that consumers will benefit from once they do use the healthcare system.
And I would imagine people are enjoying having their children on their plan until they're 26 years old.
Right. I think that was the most popular parts of the law, which was actually implemented early on in 2011, where you can add non-dependent child up to age 26 to the employer plan. And I think about 3 million people took advantage of that. And we actually saw insurance rates increase from 2010 prior to the ACA passing to 2012 because of that.
Mm-hmm. And what people are not liking?
I think one thing that people aren't liking is this perception of choice and the fact that a lot of these plans that came in to do business in the individual market were now being asked to move from making money off of selecting the people they were willing to take a risk on and really marketing and accepting those people in the old way of doing the individual market, where they were able to deny people due to pre-existing conditions and price people out. They're now being asked to control prices and sell a product that was competitive in the open market. And so a lot of those plans used the basic blunt instrument of price cutting and making sure that they were selling an affordable premium plan in these marketplaces. And in order to do that, they ended up entering into contracts with providers that were willing to take lower reimbursement rates than they used to pay prior to the opening of the health insurance exchange. So you're seeing low premiums, but you're seeing a more narrow network of providers that are willing to take those prices. And so people might perceive that if they used to see in the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan a specific doctor at a specific hospital, signing up for the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan now doesn't necessarily mean they still have access to that provider because they've said they don't want a contract.
Mm-hmm. And what about the whole viability of the system? We've heard so often that you need a substantial number of young people who won't use their health insurance as often to make the whole system work. Have a lot of young people signed up? Do we have those figures? And is it true that we need them or the whole new system will not be viable?
So I think young people have signed up at a fairly aggressive rate. However, it's still lower than we would have expected given the subsidies and the penalties that are being used. So to give you an idea, if you just look at the people aged 18 to 34 who are eligible for tax credits, eligible for these protections, there are probably about 35% in the overall population who are currently uninsured. But right now in the health insurance marketplaces, you're seeing about 25 to 27% people in those age groups signing up. So they're under-enrolled versus older people. Now, the law kind of envisioned that this would happen. So there are two programs that exist in 2014 through 2016 called Risk Corridors and Reinsurance that basically will pay plans that have a very unfavorable risk profile, that have older, sicker people signing up who use lots of services, by taking fees from other plans who ended up with a more favorable risk profile. Maybe they had lots of young people signing up. So for the next 3 years, there's a program in the law that will help balance that market so that premiums don't go up a lot. But we want to make sure that people are signing up who are younger and healthier by 2016. And the law is designed to do that by increasing the penalty over the years, where it starts at 1% of taxable income now and goes up to 2.5% of taxable income by 2016.
Mm. You know your health care. This is good. You really know the ins and outs of this. And the reason that people in that age group would not be signing up is because they feel invincible and they think it's just something they don't need, because it sounds like it would be pretty affordable.
Right. So I think, I mean, that's one of the issues where the young invincibles are, you know, people under 30 may not perceive health risks and think, well, why would I pay $50 a month or $100 a month for a health plan when I never go to the doctor anyway?
Right.
So I think that's a concern. And right now, those penalties are the $95 per person or 1% of income and, you know, of taxable income. So it's still very low compared to the actual price of premiums you would pay, whereas it'll be very close to the actual price of premiums you would pay out in 2016. And, you know, I think people all envision that they're invincible when they're young. I know I did. And over time, you have to figure out what you're actually going to have needs around in terms of healthcare and prevention and getting services you need and being able to go to the hospital if you break your leg or hurt yourself in an urgent situation is still very important. And having that protection from bankruptcy that health insurance provides might be more compelling as the fines go up and people start seeing the fairly affordable premiums that are available through the exchanges, but also the fact that you can get tax credits to help you purchase that premium.
We're going to go to phone calls and emails in just a moment. Our guest this hour, as we talk about the Affordable Care Act, as you know, the deadline for signing up is this Monday, March 31st. How are things going? How many people are signing up? What are people enjoying about this? Where are problems in sign-ups? Dylan Robbie is assistant professor and researcher at the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, earned his PhD in public policy from George Washington University, and teaches courses on the U.S. healthcare system, quality, and health information technology. Here's how you reach us. Have you signed up? Are you thinking about signing up? Are you in the process of signing up? Are you not signing up for whatever reason, particularly if you're a young person? Are you signing up? Are you not signing up? And what do you think about the long-term effects of the Affordable Care Act? Will the political discussion change after March 31st, or is it still, there's still so much opposition to this Affordable Care Act that we'll continue to see it be a major discussion point in midterm elections and beyond? We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hour two of our program today, this man has lived at least four or five different lives. Jeffrey Masson will be with us. His latest book is Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. He writes about why it is that human beings are the only beasts on Earth that kill millions of their own. He looks at many, many different animals and has changed the way he lives his life as a result of close examination of whales and crocodiles and giraffes and dogs. And he's a very, very interesting man, so stay tuned for that conversation. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, starting with Diane in Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
What do you do if you have a college student, 22 years old, and he's got a small part-time job, doesn't make enough for Obamacare, and will not be, his parents are on Medicaid, but he's not allowed to be on Medicaid for the state of Wisconsin.
Sure. So I think one of the issues is that Wisconsin has decided not to engage in that voluntary expansion. So the criteria for getting into the covered, the insurance exchange is at the actual federal poverty level, 100% of the federal poverty level, which is about $12,000 given the year for an individual. So he doesn't have a lot of options because the Medicaid expansion doesn't apply, and the Medicaid program currently covers people who are seniors and persons with disabilities or kids and their parents. So one option might be to purchase through the school that he's attending. So usually schools have, colleges have a student health plan that will be fairly low cost, maybe between $1,000 and $1,500 per year, that may have a deductible and a specific network of providers. So that may be one option to look into. The other option is actually to pay full price in the health insurance exchange in Wisconsin. And I believe, depending on where you live, the full price for a 21-year-old would be between $191 and about $350 for a policy per month. And so if they have enough money to do that for the next 7 months of the year, they could actually pay full price because of the fact that an insurance company won't be able to reject them due to any health care needs.
Well, they obviously can't do that. That's a lot of money.
Right, exactly. So I think that's why the tax credits are there. So, you know, Wisconsin has been pretty vocal about not expanding the Medicaid program, not taking that additional federal money, but other states have been able to do that. And, you know, states like Illinois, Michigan, mm-hmm. and Minnesota have agreed to expand and get that 100% federal matching fund for the next 3 years.
So to be clear, those people who live in states like Wisconsin and have situations like Diane's son or daughter, I think she said son, they're kind of out of luck. I mean, they've fallen through the cracks here.
Right, absolutely. And so I think then it becomes an issue of knowing what resources are available to you at the local level, mm-hmm. what public hospitals exist, what community health centers are around, if you can use student health programs and those types of things. The other thing that's possible is that, you know, some states have expanded their kind of child health insurance programs over the years, and there may be some public programs people are actually eligible for that either pay a share of their health care costs or would enroll them in a subsidized health care program. So I think talking to a local county or state eligibility worker, financial counselor at a hospital or health center could be helpful as well. There are lots of those types of programs that have built over the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that was somewhat helpful, Diane.
Thank you very much for your help.
Yeah, thank you. Kate is next in Grand Rapids. Hi.
Hi. So I'm actually a Wisconsin resident, so I'm in Minnesota, but I called to sign up for Obamacare, and I would really be happy if this was successful because I think our country really needs it. But I was told that, you know, it's going to be $150 a month plus a $10,000 deductible. So they want me to spend nearly $12,000 a year before I get to see a doctor. So it's really a catastrophic insurance plan rather than a health care plan.
Well, so are you, I'm assuming you're buying for a family rather than
an
individual?
No, just myself. Just me.
Okay. Because the federal law says that it's supposed to be $6,350 for individual out-of-pocket maximum. So did you call the Minnesota MNSure exchange, or did you call the Wisconsin exchange, or are you going directly through other insurance plans?
I'm going directly to the healthcare.org. Because Wisconsin doesn't have an exchange, we have to call healthcare.org.
Okay. Well, so you should be protected by that out-of-pocket maximum that's described in federal law, and, you know, I'm not sure why you're getting this very catastrophic plan offered to you if you're an individual.
Well, I guess it's the deductible, and I think that's where the key lies, is that the deductible is $10,000.
Mm-hmm. Also, is your income below $46,000 a year, if you don't mind me asking? Okay, so you should qualify for tax subsidies. So is that $150 amount you quoted after subsidies, or have you not? Okay.
Yeah.
So you're not getting a huge amount of subsidies. You're probably only getting about $40 or $50, but you can use that budget to buy any plan you want. So you could decide, I'm going to pay $200 to get a silver plan, which would be a $2,000 deductible, let's say, with quite a few copays, you know, reductions in copays. So it may be more effective, if you're really scared about the high deductible plan, to buy a slightly more generous plan in the silver, gold, or platinum tiers of plans that have either no deductible or lower deductibles, even though you're paying a little bit over in premium.
So that is on the silver plan.
Okay. I'm not sure that that is. So a silver plan is supposed to pay for about 30% of your you're supposed to pay about 30% of your healthcare costs on average, and the government is basically paying 70% of your healthcare costs on average. And I'm not sure the math works out for it at a $10,000 deductible. To give you an idea, here in California, the silver plan is a $2,000 deductible with basically $50 copays. So it seems that something's wrong with the plan they're selling you, or the $10,000 deductible doesn't make a lot of sense.
And So did you talk to somebody about this, or you just went yourself and signed up online, or what, Kate?
I talked to them on the 1-800 number at healthcare.org, and so that is what the girl told me on the phone.
I see. So she may want to talk to somebody else, it sounds like.
Yeah, or if you go on healthcare.gov and shop around for plans, you'll be able to see exactly what's offered. But a silver plan should be a lot more generous than the numbers you're describing.
Yeah. Time to look again, Kate, and do it soon. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hi. I have a working family. We probably make just under $40,000 a year. And I get insurance offered through my work, but we got to pay the full premium. And right now I'm paying about just shy of $700 a month for a family of three. Should I be shopping on the federal government website to see if I can actually have a little bit better price?
Yes. So the law basically says that if an employer offers you coverage, but it represents more than 9.5% of your wages for the single premium, so if you were to be insured by yourself but not have your family with you, that's the affordability trigger that basically needs to be pulled in order for you to go from your employer plan and qualify for subsidies in the exchange. Given the dollars you were quoting me, you would have to figure out what the lowest cost individual plan offered to you through your employer would be, and figure out if that is 9.5% or lower than your actual wages. If it's more than 9.5% over, then you are allowed to go into the exchange and get tax credits to help you purchase insurance for your entire family.
All right, Matt, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Karen in Milwaukee. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I don't know whether you answered this a couple of calls back, but I'm frustrated in that I'm on a COBRA plan that is probably almost $600 a month, and then $7,000 deductible. This is for a single person, and when I try to get Affordable Care Act coverage, they said because I didn't make $12,000 or $13,000, I would not get subsidized. I'd have to pay full price, which to me, I think, is what you were talking about, falling between the cracks. It doesn't make sense to me that someone that's making less actually has to pay more. So that's my question. If that's true, I mean, it seems to be. And then the other thing is the plan that I'm on now, I'm afraid to give up the COBRA if I suddenly go to one of these plans and pay full price and then something falls through or whatever. Does the outside the Affordable Care Act plans, are they set to the same standards that are taking effect, that you were talking about earlier as far as certain coverage and not more than this and as far as deductibles and all that kind of stuff?
Sure. So I'll start with the last question, and then remind me if I forget anything.
Okay.
So the first thing is that in the individual market and in the small group market, so if you are an individual trying to buy coverage or if you work for a firm that has fewer than 50 employees and they're trying to buy coverage on your behalf, the two markets have to be identical to each other in terms of those consumer protections. So whether you're buying through the Wisconsin health or through the Wisconsin individual market, through an insurance broker online, through a health insurance plan, or you're trying to sign up through healthcare.gov, you should see almost exactly the same premium prices. You should see very similar benefits. You should see exactly the same benefits and very similar products being offered. So they have to, all of the plans have to sell you insurance if you want to buy it. They can't exclude you due to pre-existing condition, whether you're in healthcare.gov or not. They also have to protect you in terms of pricing, where a 64-year-old can only be charged three times more than a 21-year-old. Smokers can be charged 50% more than non-smokers. So there are these price protections in the law that apply both to the health insurance exchange and the individual market outside of that health insurance exchange.
Hmm.
On the COBRA issue, it is complex because your COBRA issue is not only related to affordability of coverage, but also the fact that your income is low enough that you should be in Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
But the income you told me is a little bit higher than I would expect for them to tell you don't qualify for Medicaid or for health insurance subsidies. So for a single person earning...
I make zero right now. So
okay. I thought you said something about 12 to 13.
Nothing they can do
right.
about subsidizing
okay.
me. I make too little money to be subsidized, which doesn't make sense to me.
Okay.
And I'm, thanks to Scott Walker, I live in Wisconsin, so the Medicaid isn't expanded.
Right. So for people who are right on that borderline of Medicaid, the law says that the federal government is going to give money to states to expand the Medicaid program now voluntarily for people earning up to about $12,000, $13,000 a year. If they fall below that and the state does not expand Medicaid, there's a provision of the law that allows you to get subsidies through healthcare.gov if you're earning right at the poverty level. So there are going to be people who earn $9,000 who are told you cannot sign up for Medicaid or for health insurance exchange coverage, but if they're earning $11,000, they can actually still sign up for health insurance exchange coverage with subsidies. So there's this odd overlap between the criteria because of that Supreme Court decision. So it sounds like you don't qualify for Medicaid. So you could go into the individual insurance market, but you would again have to pay full price. And if your income is nothing, then you couldn't afford it.
Right.
The COBRA plan may provide decent coverage for now, but it seems to be more expensive to me than what you could probably get in the exchange because you are protected by price and you don't have to worry about tax credits. For people who are eligible for tax credits because of their income, they should be very careful if they lose their job and are offered COBRA. If you turn down COBRA from day one, and decide to go into the health insurance exchange, you can get subsidies to help you buy coverage as long as you don't earn over 400% of the poverty level. If you take the COBRA, you're going to be locked into that COBRA coverage until you lose that coverage, and that will trigger a special enrollment period that allows you to sign up for the health insurance exchange with tax credits.
Hmm. Professor, it's obvious that each one of these situations can be fairly complicated. Where do you recommend people go? Because you're going to need some counseling as to what your situation is and what's best for you. What do you do?
Sure. So a lot of the states have patient navigator programs or what are called health insurance assister programs. But many states have also allowed for insurance agents and brokers to get commissions on the policies they sell through the exchange, of course. So you could go to an insurance agent or broker that you trust. You can go to a community organization that has a patient navigator grant and has these patient navigators. Or you can call the line directly. And I think, you know, after the rush has ended and in open enrollment next year, maybe it'll be easier to get through to those customer service reps at healthcare.gov and get your questions answered. But I think getting that in-person assistance or phone assistance through a navigator or a sister or an insurance agent is often really helpful because they are complex and it's different in every state.
Right. Thank you so much and good luck to you, Karen. Kathleen on email says, regarding a previous caller, I believe her mistake was that she was on the wrong website. She kept saying healthcare.org. That is a health insurance site, but not the correct one. She needs to go to healthcare.gov. I don't know if she's being fleeced, but she's not seeing plans that qualify under the law. That could be her situation, huh? Let's go to Jay in Western Wisconsin. Hi, Jay.
Hi there. How are you doing?
All right, Jay. How are you?
Good. Jay, my comment is I do not qualify for subsidies. I make just a little too much money, so I do not qualify for subsidies. And for me and my wife and a family of three kids, to get a silver plan in the counties I'm in, it's over $2,000 a month without subsidy. So basically, by the time I pay that $2,000 a month premium and like a $5,000 deductible approximately, I'm out almost $30,000 before I have any coverage. So to me, it's almost the unaffordable health plan, not the affordable health plan.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, the way in which prices work in our healthcare system are very locally driven. And I was noticing when I was looking at the Wisconsin website that you have some regions in the state where a single person can buy a plan for $140 for a bronze plan, which is, you know, usually a $5,000 deductible. But in a neighboring county, it's $300 for the same exact plan, the same exact person. So there is a wide variation by where you're living. My advice would be to shop around for coverage off of the exchange since you're not subsidized already, and you may be able to find a low-cost plan there because the same plans that are selling in healthcare.gov are not always selling outside of healthcare.gov, and you'll still be protected by the same guaranteed issue coverage, by the same essential health benefits that are required, by the same age rating, and you may find a better deal there, maybe with a more narrow network. It may be a smaller plan that isn't selling on healthcare.gov. Hmm. The other thing you could consider doing is downgrading from a silver plan to a bronze plan. And you're actually, because you have been offered a premium that is much higher than 8% of your income, it seems, you're actually going to be allowed to opt out and get what's called a hardship exemption because you're spending over 8% of your income on health insurance. And you wouldn't have to pay the mandate penalty in the first place.
Yeah. So why would it be that the cost would vary so much from one locality to another within the same state?
You know, it boils down to lots of different issues. One that's probably the most popular reason is market consolidation and the types of providers that do business in an area and also the underlying health costs of that population. So if you're in a region that has lots of people who are between 60 and 64, there's a high rate of obesity and chronic illness, when the insurer came in and tried to price the premium, they knew that those characteristics were an issue, and they priced the premium much higher because they knew they would be spending a lot more money in claims in that area than they were in a neighboring area. On the market consolidation side, if you're located around a couple really high-priced hospitals that you know, are academic medical centers, they do lots of specialty care, they might charge a lot more money, and health insurers have to pay them more to get them into their network.
Hmm. Interesting. Jay, thanks very much for your call. Elizabeth in Wausau, hi.
Hi. I
was listening and heard the lady that called in about the college student. We have a similar situation. I'm a single parent, work a job that really does not allow me to carry my kids on my insurance through my employer. So they're kind of on their own. We did work with a community representative or whatever you call them that help you enroll. And what we found out, my daughter did go on, and her plan would have been somewhere about $130 a month. And she's just got a little 10-hour job on campus. So obviously she does not make very much money. What we found out was that I had been claiming her on my taxes as a dependent. In order for her to qualify for lower premium through Badger Care, I would have to not claim her as a dependent. She would have to be on her own. Then she would go through the healthcare.gov and sign up, and then she would be allowed to go into the state program of Badger Care, where she would have a very minimal premium.
Right.
And also her copays for a prescription that she needs on a regular basis would be just a few dollars versus out of pocket it was $90 on up a month. And the through the healthcare exchange, that prescription would not be covered. She'd still have to pay that out of pocket in addition to her premium. So I just wanted to put that out there in case there's other families who are, you know, financially in a bind and are in a similar situation with a college student.
So can I ask how old your daughter is? Is she under 21?
She's 22.
Okay. So, so I think that is a sticky situation because of the fact that she's still earning about $10,000 a year, it seems, and would fall under the Medicaid threshold. And because the Medicaid program wasn't expanded, there will be a point at which she ages out of the old Medicaid program that covers people through the either Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance program that Wisconsin has. So
yeah,
there might be a shift that occurs there. But you did make an excellent point about dependency and where somebody falls in someone's tax return. So if you are a family and let's say you have three people in the family, you don't have access to employer-based insurance, and you have a 23-year-old living at home who you technically can count on your taxes, but it might be more advantageous to tell the federal government, I'm going to take them off of my taxes in 2014. They are going to be independent in 2014 with a certain estimated income, and they might then qualify for either Medicaid if they're young enough or for subsidies in the exchange to help them buy coverage, even though the whole family wouldn't be enrolled.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. I mean, it might be a solution for some people. Obviously we're hoping she's going to graduate soon and be able to get a job and get insurance. But, when you're thrown a loop like this, you just kind of have to take it as it comes and hope for the best.
Yeah, thank you, Elizabeth, very much for the call. The more you hear these kinds of callers, the more you realize that there are certain fundamental principles about health care in this country and who should have a basic amount and how much that should cost that just haven't been fully answered, right? There's been so much political hoopla about all of this that it's keeping people like Elizabeth and some other callers from being able to have peace of mind that you get knowing that you're not going to be wiped out because of health care costs. You know, there's something off with this. It's striking to me.
Absolutely. I think, the one encouraging thing is that I think the types of calls you're getting today really reflect that people are thinking about their individual situation and how to navigate the system.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, it was often, I just have to throw my hands up in the air because nobody will insure my child or nobody will insure me or it's too expensive. And at least there are some options that people might have now. The law isn't built in a way that deals with every single option. And I think the fact that some governors and legislatures have decided not to expand the Medicaid program in 23 states creates this gap that a lot of low-income people really be hurt by.
Yeah, that's what we're hearing this hour. Let's take a quick call from Jack, and then we'll take many more. Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Jack.
Good afternoon. I've got two scenarios I'd like an answer to. What happens if you don't sign up by the 31st, and then in July or August you decide, oh, geez, I think I'd like to sign up? Or the other scenario, what if you quit a job that has health insurance, not get fired but or lose it, but actually quit a job that has health insurance after the 31st year? What would you do?
So in the first scenario, if you do not sign up by the end of open enrollment, March 31st, and you don't have a change in status, like getting married, having a child, having a big income change that qualifies you for subsidies, or you move or something like that, you will not have another opportunity to sign up until November 15th of 2014 for coverage starting January 1st of 2015. But there are lots of things that qualify you for that special enrollment period, which lasts 60 days after one of those changes in status. And the second scenario you described is actually a good example of a change in status. So you don't have to lose your job due to being laid off or anything like that. It's not linked to unemployment at all. If you lose your employer-based health insurance and you go to healthcare.gov and say, I just lost my employer-based health insurance, they will open up this new 60-day window where you can sign up for coverage, and you can report your income based on the expected amount you will earn for the next year rather than what your income was before. So you would probably, because of that lack of employment, then be able to receive quite substantial subsidies because your income would go down.
Thanks so much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. If you would like to join our conversation, we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. The deadline for sign-up is next Monday, and we're hearing from many, many people who are navigating the system right now, or unfortunately, too many calls from people who have fallen through the cracks here and are relatively poor and still having a hard time getting health insurance. Our guest knows the Affordable Care Act, as you can tell, pretty darn well. Dylan Robbie is with us, and Dylan teaches at UCLA, and his special areas of expertise, health policy and management, health affordability, health care system, and he certainly knows the Affordable Care Act. He's assistant professor and researcher at the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. Hour two of our program, the author of Beasts. This guy has had four different lives. He's really interesting. What animals can teach us about the origins of good and evil. He writes about human beings being, well, he says there's no serious evidence that supports the idea that other animals besides humans engage in mass killing of one another. Of the 5,500 mammal species on our planet, 90% are herbivores, making the notion of nature being red in tooth and claw a fallacious one. He's with us hour two to talk about beasts and what we can learn from them. More phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to Laura on email. Professor, she says, I believe a good deal of opposition to the ACA is that some people don't like the idea of paying other people's way. The emphasis on getting young, healthy people to enroll so they can subsidize those who can't pay has been a bit of a disservice. There should be more emphasis on the fact that we all benefit from a healthy society. We all benefit when our neighbors and coworkers aren't afraid to go to the doctor when they truly need attention. We all benefit when chronic diseases are caught before they require extensive treatment. We all benefit when we can make employment decisions on factors other than where can I get my health insurance?
Right. You know, I think those are excellent points. And I think one of the problems goes back to 2009 and 10, and even when President Obama was running for the presidency, where the framing politically around this issue that's been most popular is that by insuring the uninsured, you are going to offset some of their costs in uncompensated care and the fact that hospitals are doing ER visits on their behalf for free and that type of thing. And it's going to result in your premiums, yourself as a middle-income individual that's viewed as more deserving, will go down. And I think that's compelling to kind of moderate voters, but it really doesn't get into these issues of values within our healthcare system and making sure our society has better health in general. And I think, you know, maybe that argument is compelling, but I think we often fight over these little issues around government oversight and individual well-being and economic well-being versus having a pretty honest discussion about what our values are as a country related to healthcare and whether it should be a right or a privilege. I think that the law does create this option for people to actually have more freedom in the jobs they choose, in the lifestyle decisions mm-hmm. they make, where they're no longer locked into employer-based healthcare or being or worrying about losing their job because they won't have affordable healthcare offered to them. They now have this opening to actually sign up for coverage that might be affordable, qualify for a Medicaid program that will alleviate some of that burden of always having job-based coverage that we've been locked to.
Well, isn't that interesting? Another whole way to sell this, you would have more freedom. That might make it more palatable to some people, huh?
Unfortunately, it also opens up this idea that more people will get a divorce because of the Affordable Care Act, because they'll no longer be stuck in unhappy marriages linked to health insurance.
Oh my.
So I think the right has picked that up as Obamacare will increase divorce rates.
Oh, I haven't heard that one yet. Let's go to Louie in Wisconsin. Hey, Louie.
Hi.
Hi.
I got a happy story.
All right.
I haven't been working for a while, and I signed up for the Affordable Health Care Act. And I had a terrible time with that. Up until that time, I was paying for the COBRA.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to people from the healthcare, and I even met with a navigator, and they didn't hear what I was asking them. So I went right to one of the insurance companies that I saw online with the Health Care Act, and I talked to them. And seeing that I had already signed up with the healthcare, the government thing, they went to that site and they looked and they found the policy I was looking at was like a $3,000 deductible and it was $600 and some a month. And because of my income, I now pay $54.96 a month.
Wow.
I have a $500 deductible.
Oh, great.
And after my deductible is met, there is no copay for doctor visits and no copay for prescription drugs.
Ooh, you do have a happy story.
I think that I'm just happy.
My
COBRA was $450 a month, and then after the first of the year, it went up to about $600.
Uh-huh. Is this?
And now I got this one, and it's like, yeah. And the other thing with the prescription drugs, it covers tier 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Wow. Professor Robbie, you want to comment on this one?
Sure. So, I mean, congratulations.
Yes.
It's great to hear that you got affordable coverage that meets your needs. One of the things I didn't mention before, and we always talk about tax credits as the main way to subsidize health insurance coverage by reducing your out-of-pocket premium each month. But there's another subsidy that's included in the Affordable Care Act for people earning between one-time poverty and two-and-a-half times poverty. So you're talking, you know, the $12,000 up to about $30,000 a year, depending for a single person, that are called cost-sharing reductions. So if you sign up for a silver plan and you fall between those income levels of 100% of poverty up to 250% of poverty, you qualify for what's called an enhanced plan. And depending on your income level, that plan either offers no deductible, even though you're in a silver plan where it would usually be a $2,000 or $3,000 deductible, up to maybe a $1,500 deductible. So it gives you a lot lower copays. So for people in that income band, they will get more generous coverage with tax credits as well.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Louis, for calling. What do you think is going to happen politically with all of this? It's obvious that we were struck by it. It's been 4 years since this has passed, and the political rhetoric in opposition to it is just as strong as it ever has been. Will that change, do you think, or not?
I mean, I think the fact that several million people have signed up at this point, 5 million or so in the private health insurance exchanges, but also about 4 million people signing up in the expanded Medicaid programs in certain states, you end up with quite a large number of people who now have coverage through this program where if you take it away from them, that's also a political firestorm.
Interesting.
So I think a lot of the rhetoric around repeal and replace will be starting to move a little bit, and maybe we'll talk about changing some of the policies and changing federal matching formulas and things like that to support the program. But I do think the guaranteed issue insurance market, the health insurance exchanges, are probably here to stay because governors and constituents within states don't want to see those coverage options go away once they've already enrolled in them.
Hmm.
So I think, you know, the dialogue might change in the next few years, but I still think it's a very popular – the repeal and replace is a very catchy phrase, and I think we'll still continue hearing it, even though if that's not exactly what conservatives mean. Odds are it'll be a little bit more tinkering and dealing with kind of the entitlement nation as they view it and trying to kind of reduce that reliance on federal government funding.
Our guest this hour, Professor Dylan Robby. Healthcare affordability is his area of expertise. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this program. Thanks for calling and listening.